Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
That created in the services a particular kind of culture, doing things to people. And really the systems that developed, the public service providing systems that developed, drifted considerably, I think, from the reality of the situation on the ground for people living in their communities since the Second World War. At the same time, we've had in the last 20 years increasing atomisation of agencies, services that are providing support to people and communities, and that's where we're at now. That's my sort of view or feeling, and we can come back to this maybe later on. So I think it's important to bear all those issues in mind, and culture, not in a very narrow sense, but culture originating from all of those impacts from that historical legacy. So moving on to the pragmatic. I say pragmatic because actually we've heard a lot today about a lot of higher-level, very complex issues around working with people and communities. And what I'm about, what I try to promote, is actually making the whole system at the public or provider interface on the ground work for people, regardless of everything that is layered on top of them. So we've heard a lot of themes today. We know that a smart approach is to develop a team around the family, that it's multi-agency and involves multidisciplinary working. I think in the last few years, there's universal acceptance as a consequence of a lot of initiatives, particularly Total Place, that actually that's the way forward, that we need to look at issues around prevention, early intervention, across the spectrum of needs, as we call them, and that actually we need to move away from the targeting of services, and we actually need, and I think what this is all about is saying that what we do in the mainstream has got to be good and has got to work for people at the lower level. And if we make it work properly at the mainstream, there's no need for targeted practice. That's not to say there should be universal provision of every single service to every single member of the local community, but it must be responsive and reactive, respond to need and to demand and to location where there's a need for working with people. Commonly termed this approach service redesign. One of the issues is actually understanding what the needs are and where they are and what's the best way of working with people. And issues of data sharing, etc. We've heard all about that. But ultimately, the bottom line, it's the people at that interface between the public and the provider that actually know the area, know the community, know the people, that can identify the people, and can help to identify the solutions. We have a lot of local fora already set up, or versions of them that were set up recently, for example, around safer neighbourhood practice and issues to do with community safety, housing panels, different locality member models around the country, where there's a group of people, professionals, voluntary sector professionals, and local residents working together with a lot of knowledge, intelligence about local communities and local people. Service redesign is also clearly looking for a partnership effort. It's also looking to work with the workforce, and actually it's also about the top level in terms of what we're trying to do and make sure that what we're trying to do is tying in with outcomes, maybe through strategic commissioning. And ultimately, it's to realise service integration, and a consequence of which we'll see the realisation, hopefully, of efficiencies. there are lots of models, Think Family, other models that actually, we need to work with, continue. Outreach is a very good and important function at a local level. We need to be aware that we're working with a lot of very hierarchical organisations and structures, and what we can do about that to flatten those out. We know that ultimately it's important in some respects to use information technology, the ECAF, or maybe the cloud, as it could be better known in these days, and people could grasp in a more successful way, to share data and use the tools available to access systems, so that actually we're not reinventing the wheel when we write our assessments, for example. Protocols, shared protocols across the workforce, regardless of which organisation they sit in and what role they have. Potentially everybody who's working on the front line having a generalist element of their work, which enables them to identify, to take on the lead professional role, support role, and understand all the other offers available in the area to the member of the public, and help shape a package of support for them, or with them, or empower the recipient to identify what might work best for them. So it's about working proactively and responsibly, and it's about an accountable autonomy model where it's re-empowering the frontline worker and in those very important roles where actually they felt maybe very disempowered because of a lot of developments over the last 10, 20 years. So it's very much about building on partnership work, being flexible, empowering the frontline workers. Frontline workers, ultimately, the example I use is if a family who's been made homeless turn up at Children's Centre at 5 o'clock on a Friday night presenting as homeless, they know, the Children's Centre manager knows, or the outreach worker knows, what calls to make, who to, what they can do for them, and between them, they will sort out, that's the Children's Centre manager, other people and other agencies, they will sort out by 6 o'clock some kind of accommodation over the weekend so that the family is safe, and a named contact for that family to be in touch with on the Monday morning. So it can be done, and it is done informally, regardless of all the layers of service-related issues, partnership-related issues, data-related issues that we can layer over the working at the lower level, at the front line. So ultimately, I think it's about recognising, celebrating and rewarding and building incentives into the system the work that's done at the front line. It's a bottom-up process. A lot of work that I've done over the years is actually starting there. The products of the work through interactive workshops with the frontline workers, with end users, is then fed back to the senior leaders, and they're then tasked with picking up and responding to the challenge, creating some leadership, and then driving it through so that the practice that's actually informal on the ground becomes formalised, but not too formal either. I would like to leave it at that, and I invite any contributions either to what I've just said, or if anybody wants to say anything about the proceedings from today, what they've taken from that, or would like to talk about some of their practice or share it with others in the room.
I'm Olgan from Action for Children. So the almost your last point there about the children's centre worker, what might be seen as above and beyond the call of duty to resolve a problem late on a Friday tea time. I would sort of call that as sort of going the extra mile, and one of the benefits of voluntary sector partners quite often do that sort of thing. You mentioned about incentivising that kind of behaviour. Can you say a bit more about how, what your vision for that might be, or how that might work in practice?
Well, there are many different levels, whether it's through strategic commissioning, so it's incentivising the commissioners to work together rather than work in isolation. I think the bottom line is the recognition of the capability and the competence and the experience of the frontline worker to work collaboratively with their peers and with the people they've been working with. And I think for all of us, if we're recognised in what we do as being worthwhile and good, then that in itself, and if we're involved in designing or redesigning or formalising a system, and that's recognised throughout the organisations that we're just at the front face of, then that incentivises us itself. That's a good model in terms of personnel development, in empowering your staff, getting them engaged with the system, and supporting their delivery of the work is the way they best see it. We all know, actually, we can layer everything on top of the frontline worker or any worker in terms of edicts or plans or principles or priorities or targets or funding or ways of working or cultures through personnel development. But actually, unless that individual worker is intimately involved with the development and then the delivery of what they're doing, and it's related to the core purpose and the reason why they join public service, then we're not going to get the kind of working that's required to address all of these issues. So that's sort of quite a long, wide answer. But what I'm saying, ultimately, it's about people's practice, how engaged they are with what they're doing and designing what they're doing, how much recognition there is of what they have to say, and then how much support they have behind what they do. Anybody else like to say anything at all? Would they like to disagree?
It seems quite aspirational, I suppose, is what I would say. I mean, just carrying on.
You know, from a manager of a voluntary sector provision, I know why I and my people that I manage would encourage that sort of behaviour, partly because of our ethos and it's the right thing to do, and we say that we put the child at the heart of everything we do, but also in the hard reality is that you know, we're on 3-year contracts, 1-year extensions. You know, we live by our reputation, and we like to be useful, and you know, become, if we can, indispensable to the local authority, so that we'll be recommissioned. So we have a kind of real strong sort of business, if you like, case for behaving in that way.
Yeah.
But if you're and if you're a good local authority worker or public sector worker, you have your own ethos for doing it. But if you see your other partner agencies not reciprocating, then you'll become demotivated, won't you? So it's how you translate the high-level aspirational thing to the ground and make it best practice, make that everybody's kind of common practice is where I was hoping to open that up as a because we need something tangible, really, rather than just that's what we'd like to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, it's I've been working for a long time. 20 years ago, it was community consultations. Now it's customer insight. The whole principle of community planning or community development has been, you don't leave it to the planners, you talk to the people, you work with the professionals together, you identify the issues, you identify the actions, and hopefully you realise the results. Most recently, we've had Total Place, which says actually you need to go to the customer, the end user, the member of the public, and see what their experience has been over this period, map the spend, see how much money's gone into them, and then that's where you start in your plan, do review cycle, and you reflect on all that practice historically. Practically, I've worked with colleagues of yours from Action for Children, who in one London borough were very successful in winning a lot of contracts to do with housing advice in particular. But they were very good at modelling good practice models for working with the family, around the family, in an integrated way. They became the crux and the basis for the development of the multi-professional family intervention project. And I think, because it came from them, from outside the formal public sector, because they were clearly driven to organisational objectives, because they could show evidence of how they work and what work they did, because they did it as the team around the children's centre and the team around the family, as well as independently in their organisation, and because there's this groundswell, which was reflected here, which we wouldn't have seen 5 years ago, which says actually, well, although not many people did mention that this morning in their expectations, but that we start with the end user and their experiences. But because that's now universally accepted pretty much as an approach, I'm saying really is if we continue, but we look at the interface between the frontline worker and the recipient of the service, and we start there in terms of our planning of services and provisioning of services, then it can only but be a good thing. And I'm saying that, you know, in my view, it's been happening for a long period. It's happening through your organisation. It's been adopted as a model by London boroughs and across the country. And in my view, that's the progressive way forward. It's pragmatic. And it's saying, let's just get on with it. Because actually, in reality, we will never get on with it if we accept that there are blockages in the system. Because there will always be blockages, because there's various interests to create blockages. But actually, if we just get on with it, we'll work it through and it'll work.
Hi, thank you. In terms of the culture aspect, one of the things I've recognised is that as public services, we seem compelled to want to manage and live the life for our families, or these families. And do you see that a solution going forward is something radically different to that? Or do you think what we'll end up with is some way of just being smarter of doing the same thing?
Okay, yeah. Smarter and doing the same thing is... it's all about risk, ultimately. How much risk are public sector leaders prepared to take to drive through change? What messages are they going to listen to? What messages out of those that they're going to listen to are they going to hear? And then out of those, which ones are they going to respond to and address and lead on? Recently, I've been party to some research with families. Out of the cohort of 10 families, 5 of them have said, actually, we're in crisis because half of our time is spent trying to meet the obligations that we have to meet with all the services who are providing to us, rather than dealing with the crisis issues we have in our family. So actually, that's making it worse for us. And that's a very important point. So that relates to your point, which says, actually, if you take all the services away, can the family then get on and fight the fires? Or does it need some degree of support? Or does it need to be peer support? Or whatever. What different models can we use? Where is the strength in the family? Is it an economic issue? What's the economic role of parents and families? Have they been disenfranchised? Has their profile amongst their peers and through the generations been affected? The role models we know have not been there because of potentially these existential issues, the industrial change. How can we put that back into the family? How can we recreate pride within the family? Are the issues the wider issues that we hear about families and dependency and working in a system? You know, are they just the sad consequence of this historical evolution, this changing role, this lack of status or recognition within families of individual members? And do we need to understand that and actually put the power back in the family, the pride and the potential role back in the family? If that answers your question, I don't know whether you want to come back on that and answer it yourself.
No, I think that kind of started to open up some further discussion, I think, about what might that vision look like in the future, about how we might work differently. Certainly for me, you know, we have a kind of a fragmented services kind of system, which in a sense just does that. It compels itself to fulfil its own philosophy, really. Whereas what we're trying to maybe think about is how do we actually, when we talk about putting families at the centre of, what do we mean by that, and what might that look like in the future?
Yeah, I mean, is troubled families, is this just a continuation, the gravy train for those who can be employed through public funds in one way, shape or another to create reliance on the part of the beneficiaries, which so therefore it's not a sustainable model, obviously economically, because we can't keep on funding the professionals to do the work. and also it doesn't help the families either. So is it a gravy train? Is it not a gravy train? Or are the issues existential? And can we not really affect the issues on the longer term? And is this a wider question for national leaders, for government, for debate, for discussion? And obviously we also know that there are other countries with similar issues around the deficit, about skills, about retention after school, about the profile of the labour market. But do they have family behaviour, family units, family circumstances as we have them? And if not, why not? Maybe that's a national debate, a question to be asked. But I think I'm moving a little bit away. Maybe we should try and pull us back to the practical and the constructive and the positive in terms of where we are and what we're up to. But I think my point there is, though, that we have to think outside the box and reflect on the wider issues, not just the very local issues. Anybody else?
In terms of getting down to some practicalities, one of the things in Surrey which constantly frustrates me is that in terms of our CAFs, we have separate CAFs for children and separate CAFs for adults, and the numbers of times I've been advocating that we should have a family CAF, and from a district and borough that's quite challenging to try and get that message relayed up to our top tier that that's what we would like to do. And I just wonder if anybody else is working with family CAFs and whether I could come and talk to them.
I mean, my advice, I mean, I think over the last 5 years, the most powerful instrument for change, as far as I've seen, is actually to get a group of senior leaders, maybe the LSP, in the same room as the families who've experienced the issues around the multiple assessments, 30 different people knocking on the door, etc., 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 and get the families to tell their story to the senior leaders and see if the senior leaders can receive those messages and then react and respond, and maybe even do it in a public way. Has anybody else got any ideas? Sorry, that's quite a blunt way of addressing it, but ultimately, you know, we are talking about transformational change and maybe we need some blunt tools. Sorry.
Hello, it's all right. I don't know. I need this, do I? We are working in Hertfordshire, which is a massive area, you know, with 10 district councils, and putting in a whole family CAF for exactly those reasons. So I've got loads of stuff that I can give you, but we basically did loads of stakeholder analysis and came up with various options of what they wanted. So happy to talk to you about it afterwards, but we're working with two. But that's the biggest challenge because it's such a massive area.
The other challenge, I mean, in terms of procedure and process, you can get the buy-in and agreement, can't you, to develop a family CAF. But ultimately, if it's not coming from the front line and they're not engaged and they're not helping to design it, including the families, and it's not centred on the family, the family's not in it's not family-centric, is it going to work for the family and are the workers going to use the CAF? And there's lots of examples of places where the systems are in place and it's been driven through, but it's not utilised in practice. So, as I was mentioning at the outset, is it about engaging, recognising, empowering the front line, people working on the interface, people working with recipients of services, feeding into that, and it's being focused on their needs and experiences? And does that engage everybody might be working with a family CAF to realise and work with universally the system that's designed and put in place for them? Because actually, if we've got a family CAF, but only 30% of referrals are going through the system, then are people going to use the system? Because actually there might be an assessment somewhere else that's not recorded centrally. Why waste my time? Why should I do it? Might be out there, there's an issue arisen in the school, too much work to fill the CAF. I don't know whether somebody else has written an assessment because it may not be on the electronic system. I'm too busy anyway. Maybe I will not refer on. keep it quiet. They'll be through school in a few years' time anyway. And I'm sure we all know those scenarios. Sorry to be really pessimistic, but I think it's important to be clear about what actually goes on, and no matter what we design, what's the reality of the practice. The gentleman there at the back.
I was going to make more of a comment than a question about how you get organisations to use the same sort of tools. I worked in Hertfordshire for 15 years, and it was a big council. But even where you had a big council trying to push one system, what you also found is there were lots of other organisations who may only have had a small presence in the county, but were bigger nationally than the county was. And I think in any sector, not just in the public sector, you'll get some leaders who are very good at developing some systems, but just as quickly as that, you'll get others who develop the competing systems. So you get things like the mobile phone and IT market, and people like Microsoft and Google and Apple have all produced big systems, and that's the answer to everybody's solution. But you end up with two or three people working in different directions who won't cooperate with each other because they've got something big that they want everybody else to follow. And I think perhaps from that, there's the message for those of us working with people, which is rather than focusing on the systems and trying to get the one universal system that everybody's going to follow, we need to organise ourselves in a way that we're going to be receptive to and able to take information from organisations in whatever format they come, and from that be able to extract the things that we most need to work with, so we don't need to keep going back to families and asking them the same questions in exactly the same way as people using iPhones and people using Microsoft systems have been able to cope with the systems of their competitors.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, I mean, there are tools, technologies to assist us. You know, it's a process still, and it takes us away from the human input, but actually it can be liberating too, and it can create behaviour change in itself. And that's why I'm starting to talk about the cloud, for example, rather than the ECAF system. Because I think for about a year now, most people are understanding what the cloud is, what its impact can be, and how liberating it can be and accessible. And I think that's important, particularly in the areas where, you know, through the Integrated Work Initiative several years ago, the introduction of CAF and then the ECAF, that didn't take off. Maybe there's a new way of representing that, but at the same time, working at the front line to represent it and redesign it and roll it out. It's really interesting. We are in, I don't know if anybody knows much about this building we're in relation to this neighbourhood and the impact on the development of this community, business community in particular, but in Marsat, I think, first established their offices here about 30 years ago. And as I understand it, they created satellite systems for maritime uses. And they were the only IT company in the whole area, in a very run-down area. And because of the technologies and the creativity of the sector and the focus that they had on the sector and the potential development that could occur here in Old Street in London, they created a huge development of systems and expertise and practice and behaviour change amongst people working in their sector, their competitors, and that's why this area is developed and is known as, not Silicon Valley over in California, but this area is actually known as the new Silicon Valley, right here within this radius of about half a mile, because they've created and they've generated all that creativity. And it's not just about the businesses developing and progressing, but it's all the services and the implications of all those technological developments for end users, the iPhone, apps, the cloud. And so I think it's an interesting model. It's very different from tribal families, but it's something which potentially is quite interesting in terms of changing the way we work with people on the front line. Anybody else or any comments from cyberspace, people watching from outside? Okay, I think that It's been a long day, and I hope I haven't created too much in terms of issues around processing of ideas or of issues that have arisen throughout the day, and that you have a nice evening, and thank you very much for seeing it through, and nice to meet you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.